Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we're going to talk about shrinking, finally.
Like, yeah.
Really talk about it. Adam's caught up. But yeah. First, you went and saw two movies this weekend.
Yes, I did.
I think it's surprising which one is making bank and which one is doing okay.
Yeah, like after I saw the numbers that came out, I was like, oh, go ahead.
I would not have bet money on Wicked being a huge box office success. I would not have bet on that.
I would have ish because of just kind of the cultural impact. I mean, it's weird because it's like, I was at, like, I don't know if we've talked about this. I think we've talked about this on, offline, but I don't think that we've talked about it online. Maybe we have just a little bit. But I got to see that show. I got to see Wicked when Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth were there. Like, I was actually, at a previous life, I was a corporate trainer for a specific bank. I won't say which bank, but they had me train in New York for new branches during the time frame that it actually premiered, and I got to see it with them in it, and I got to see it twice. I got to see it, and it's very specific the reasons why I say this, because I got to see it at a night show, which is, it's a little bit saucier, a little bit different, but then I got to see it at a matinee. And I think the matinee is what rewired me, because during those first years, or the first year of the 2-year run that they did, the matinees, what they would do is after the show was done, all of the kids under the age of 5 got to meet the Wicked Witch of the West and Glinda. And I'll tell you this, I think that those children, however many children saw this show, that it's like, you know, that whole theory about like how like only seven people listened to the Velvet Underground.
But right. Those 20 people made the greatest bands of all time.
Exactly. And then they got listened to. And then like, I think that it was a concentric circle of, because like, my wife like wants to kill me because she wants to trade places with me. She wanted to see them because she was a theater kid that got influenced by this. And so like, there's all these little theater kids that turned into like, you know, adults. And I think that it was something that you couldn't size up because it was something that was ephemeral until they started doing like the 20 year anniversary of Wicked. And plus it's Wizard of Oz, right? Like, it is beautifully Wizard of Oz. And then you have the books too, because it's based on a book, like an actual book. I wasn't a surprised, but I'm astounded by the numbers, by the fact that this thing is probably by the end of the year going to be one of the top grossers, if not, like, if it keeps on going like the way that it's going, because it's like it was inorganic, it felt like, because of the TikTok thing. But now it feels like, because the numbers are coming in, it's like a really organic thing. Like, I was kind of like, oh shit, this thing could do like big numbers in a surprising way that I don't think that people were ready for. And plus, it's a good fucking movie. Like,
That's everything I'm hearing. And like, I have had zero interest in going to see this, mostly because I didn't see it on Broadway, but I have seen the stage play with the I think it was the original touring stage play. So it would have
Oh,
been
wow.
like seeing the second best performances of
But
the original play.
yeah, that's major, dude. Like seeing that touring company is like that first era touring company was legit because I saw them. Because when they finally came to LA, I was like, you know what? Like the woman that I was with at the time, I was engaged with at the time, I was like, you really do need to see this because I mean, and this is the weirdest part about it. Every woman I've dated has been obsessed with The Wizard of Oz or some form or fashion of it, right? I don't know what that says about me. And that company was legit. Like I've seen a lot of touring companies of shows, and some are very, very shitty. Like they're real shitty.
I mean, the
This one's
production of
not.
it was just fantastic. I saw it at the Fox Theater in Atlanta,
Atlanta,
which is a
that's a great
great,
to see.
it's a great venue. Like the effects work, like everything was so great. And I mean, that's been so long ago. Probably, God,
Has to be like 20 years, like close to 20
yeah,
years ago.
close to 20, if not 20, if not 20, real close to it, like 18, 19 years. And like I still remember it. So like this, I was just like, I don't know, man. Like I don't, it's 2.5 hours. The original stage play is about 2.5 hours. I was just
And
like,
this is only a first part.
yeah.
Like this is part one of two. They chopped it like, wow,
I
yeah.
also didn't love the fact, I get why you don't market it as a musical. I get marketed musicals don't do well, but like this is one of the most famous musicals of all time and easily the most famous musical of the last few decades. Like I get people that don't know musicals don't know it's a musical, but it's pretty fucking famous. So like I didn't love that they were being tricky with the marketing. It also made me think that they didn't have something worthwhile. And then now everybody I know seen it and has been like, oh no, this is absolutely wonderful. I've had people tell me that like, oh yeah, I cried multiple times watching it, the performances, the songs, the like it just so now I'm like, oh fuck, I've got to go see this now.
Yet, like, to be honest, if you've seen the stage play, you kind of do. You kind of owe it to yourself too, because I will say this, like, so my wife watched it, and I swear to God, dude, for 3 hours, Christina cried. Like, it was that effective. But I mean, she was a theater kid when this came out. Like, we're 8 years apart, so when this came out, like she was literally in high school. Like she was in junior high going into high school, and then it became a thing because she was a theater kid. She so like to see this translated was like the only equivalent I have for it is like I know this is gonna sound weird, especially for a fucking guy who constantly shits on this director's like filmography, but it was the only equivalent I had. No, actually, you know, I'll go back. It was that first screening of Phantom Menace, except for instead of seeing something that we tricked ourselves into saying that was like was of the level and not something different, but like the Phantom Menace, it felt like that surge of that first screening, except for like this has been like 3 or 4 days later, and I'm still thinking about this movie is like it's probably one of the best musical adaptations of a stage play in a long time, if maybe ever. Like there are a couple of movies that I hold in high regard as like, you know, like translated like, most of the time, like what I feel movie musicals that are good are the ones that are not adapted from stage plays, like Singing in
Yeah,
the Rain,
it is
Wizard of
so
Oz.
hard, so hard to adapt a stage play.
We just like I feel like the Elite is Funny Girl, and it's just because you had the original, like Barbra Streisand starred in the original stage play and she
I think,
translated into
yeah, I think Grease is up there.
yeah,
But
I'm
Grease
not a fan of
also
it, but
does the
Grease.
thing where they're adapting a stage musical, but they're veering away from a lot of the, like it becomes more of a movie, because yes. It doesn't feel like it's set pieces, but it doesn't feel inorganic. Like the only thing in Greece that feels like so bizarre is the thing at the end. So.
No. So, yeah. Like everything else feels like when you've seen that stage play and then you've seen the live, the movie, they kind of somehow got it. Like they got the translation right. Like this musical numbers still felt like the stage, but also felt very, very like cinematic. Like I think of Grease Lightning. Because like, you start on a stage, like you start in very artifice, but then once Grease Lightning, once the car is done,
becomes a stage, and then it goes back to being a car. Like it's really, really hard to do that, and really both our points, it has not been done well at all in. Nope.
50 years?
40 or 50 years? Like, 50 years? People mean, just can't do it.
Yeah, Greece is 78, right? So, like, even things that I appreciate, like, I'm a big Stephen Sondheim fan, so Stephen Sondheim. And
I was going to say, the one thing that might come close is Sweeney Todd.
And even then, they gut that film. Or they gut that musical. Like, they take it from a 3-hour and 20-minute musical to, like, an 1-hour and 20-minute movie. Like they gut that thing. But it works because like, basically Tim Burton, like, wills it into existence. And basically makes, like, just takes the seven best songs in that movie and somehow manages to tell the story of that musical. Like, Into the Woods doesn't work. And Disney spent $150 million on that movie, and it doesn't work. It falls flat. Like, Wicked is, like, the weird part is Wicked is literally, like, okay, so Wicked Part 1 is everything up until Defying Gravity, right? But they imbue it with a lot of the, like, they expand things. So, like, I think that what the brilliance is that they had the book, and then they took some of the stuff from the book and added it in so that the music isn't just telling the story. They're expanding on it. And they take a couple of musical numbers out, which I think are going to be put into the second, because you can't just, like, after Defying Gravity, the show is, for better or for worse, it peaks on Defying Gravity, which, like, literally gets you to the intermission. And then it goes into the second half of it. But everybody has said that the other big thing is that Dorothy and the other, Dorothy and her, like, her fellowship, they play a side role in the musical. Like, you never really, like, it's all, like, you, like, it's all artifice, it's all in the side, but from everything that everybody has talked about is that Wicked Part 2 actually has Dorothy and the Cowardly Lion and everybody in there. And so it's going to change the shape of the musical. And so it's going to be interesting talking, like, you know, seeing that. But what it beautifully does is it does that trick that Grease does, which is, like, it takes a stage play, something that's very stage bound, and somehow magically changes it into this wonderful thing that expands upon everything that you everything that you love about the show is there, but it's extra, extra. And, like, I will tell you that, like, like, the thing that I was worried about were the side characters, like the wizard and, like, all of the side supporting roles, but it's not just like having Jeff Goldblum there isn't a stunt casting. Like, he really is great in that role. It's a really thoughtful adaptation, but then it makes sense because Winnie Holtzman, who wrote the book for the original, and Stephen Schwartz were both involved with were both involved with this adaptation. And you could feel the like handcrafted care and love that they do with it. I mean, it's literally like after I got out, I was like, you know what? I need to see it again, but it's definitely top five material. Like it's that good of a magic trick that they do. It's on par. You know what? Actually, I take it back. It's the way that Potterheads felt when they watched the first movie. Like not to say that the first movie is great, but they got it right.
It gets you that, like, that feeling of like, oh, they're not going to fuck this up.
Yeah, exactly. That's 100% what it is. It really is. Like I always felt it was like a weird choice to have John Chu direct it, but he's actually the perfect choice. Now that I look back on it, all of his stuff is
It is a bizarre, like when it was like, oh, John Chu's going to do this. It is like, if you're a movie buff, if you're yeah. It is like, wait, what?
I mean, but, this is literally the dude that did the second G.I. Joe movie. I mean, which is ironic because his movie is going against like the Pebbles like newest.
Yeah.
And we'll get to, you know, Moana 2, which I'm not saying it's a bad movie. Like, but Wicked, when you see it, you go, yeah, there's like, I don't understand how. Like, how did they do this? Like, that's the thing, ultimately. Like, John Chu is, like, you look at his filmography, and it's not, I mean, this is the guy that started off as the documentarian of fucking Bieber. Like, the Bieber documentarian. And literally, this dude has willed himself, I mean, yes, Crazy Rich Asians. Like, fucking, like, you look at that and go, okay. But, you know, a clock is always right twice a day, right? Like, but this is something entirely different. Like I will hunt. I mean, he was a part of the Willow thing, right? And Willow was kind of like, okay. I mean, it's not great. It's not, was not terrible, but like Wicked is like an elevation. Like I will say this, I will not be surprised. I will actually be shocked if he doesn't get nominated for Best Director because it's that good of an adaptation.
I mean, yeah, I've heard some people thought like, oh, this could be, you know, definitely nominated for Best mm-hmm. Picture. So,
like, it is.
It's crazy. It makes me want to, I didn't see In the Heights, but it makes me want to, mm-hmm. like, I want to watch this. I want to go back and watch In the Heights, which that's a musical too, right?
Yeah, that's actually a Lin-Manuel musical. That was his first musical. That was actually his, like, it's weird because it's his high school, like, it's his college project that ended up being a super big hit and winning him his first Tony. But yeah, like, this one is, it's like, that one is good. I have it on 4K. Like, actually, me and my wife had talked about wanting to go back to it because it was good. But I we saw it in such weird conditions because it was like, I haven't reapproached it since it was released during the pandemic. And I know that it was made pre-pandemic. So it doesn't have that pandemic stink to it. But
There's a Jim and the Holograms movie. How did I miss this?
Wait, you don't know about the Gems in the Hologram movie?
No.
Oh, shit. Oh, man, how can I put this? It takes itself too seriously. He directed it. He directed it right after G.I. Joe. It takes itself too seriously, and it's a prequel, so it kind of, like, does the, but it's not, like, you know what? It stands in the shadow of Josie and the Pussycats, which I really adore.
I mean, that's one of those underrated movies.
Oh,
that, like, enough people didn't like it, but the people that did see it are like, oh, yeah, no, that's actually a solid movie. Like, with good music.
Yeah. Good music, and man, at the time when all these boy, I hated the boy bands, and like their evisceration of the boy bands.
Yeah, with
Seth good.
Green and Breckin Meyer. It's so funny, man. Yeah,
that was the first time I I was like, why did it? I could not like. I mean, like that fucking movie is so good. Like, yeah. My friends and I, when we saw it, we were kind of like, we were seeing it for one reason, but it completely turned out to be a different.
I was in love with Rachel Lee Cook, so yep. I was, Dawson. Yeah, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm here for Rachel Lee Cook, but like I watched it and I was like, oh, this like legit a really good skewering of this like kind of pop culture, like manufactured pop culture. It's really funny. The music just is so catchy and fun, and it's got a great cast. What's his name that plays like the sleazy manager dude?
Alan Cummings.
Yeah, Alan Cummings.
Oh God,
it's just
together.
God.
Who's the other one? Paolo Costanzo.
Yeah.
Like they're all like three of them are like kind of great. The biggest thing for me is how I knew that I was in for something completely different. I was like, oh, okay. So like the three leads aren't like, cause it was like, wait, that movie came out when I think I was in my early 20s.
2001.
Yeah. Okay. So like early 20s. Yeah, absolutely. Early to mid 20s. But the thing that got to me was when they showed Du Jour and Seth Green and Breckenmeyer were together, because like we had this whole joke that Breckenmeyer and Seth Green were the same person. It just with a prosthetic nose. And like, we just thought that it was the funniest thing because it's like two little dudes that were like basically taking up the same area of like filmdom, but they never starred in things together. To see them together was kind of like in itself an in joke to us. And we were like, oh yeah. Oh yeah, this is great. But Gems and the Holograms is kind of trying to trade on Josie and the Pussycat. It's just, it's not as, like, you want it to do the sarcastic thing, but it does the very serious thing, which it's kind of like, oh, well, it's kind of beautiful to look at because it does the thing of, like, that, like, it does the very real adaptation. It's made for, like, people that, like, it was made for, like the seven people that took Gem and the Holograms seriously when they were a kid, remembered everything about it, and like still wanted a very serious adaptation. So it's kind of totally a wonky ass fucking movie, but it's a Gems and the Holograms movie. Like he directed it like it was like, you know how like his G.I. Joe is very much so like the Retaliation is very much so of the comics and of the cartoon. He does the same
of the two. I think his is definitely
much
the better movie.
Summers makes a movie that I don't even know, like he makes a Steven Summers movie. He doesn't make a G.I. Joe movie.
Yeah.
Like too understood, but it's like imagine that kind of serious tone of Retaliation but with no winking and nod, and that's what you get with the Gems Hologram and the Holograms movie. But I would definitely say as a, like, if somebody had missed it and like you and I, where we are and how old we are, like it definitely is worth a look. Like it definitely, cause you may actually I didn't like.
Yeah. I'm going to spend all of December going through John Chu's filmography. All right. So going to Moana real quick. Also a movie, I enjoyed the first Moana. I really did. But this is another one that, it's actually the flip of Wicked, where I thought Wicked, I was like, I just don't think anybody's going to want to go see this, especially when word gets out that like, oh, hey, yeah, it's a 2.5-hour musical. So, pass. Moana was such a, it's not really a surprise when Disney has a hit, but like in that Frozen level of like, oh shit, like a lot of people really, really love this. And it kind of like continued to grow on home video rather than like, oh, it was a hit in the theaters and then it just died. Moana 2 was a huge surprise announcement. Like, people didn't even know they were making Moana 2. And then it was like, oh, yeah, in theaters, you know, in November is going to be Moana 2. I think they announced it in, like, January or something.
It was at, it was November-ish because it was at a D23 or something.
That's right, It was like, yeah, next year, Moana 2. And everybody was like, wait, what?
Exactly. And they announced it at the same time that they were doing the live action. As they announced the live action Moana, which I think that's what
weirder.
Yeah. Because, like, I think we even had a conversation out of D23 because it was the same one where Harrison Ford went and whole kerfuffle of bullshit. But yeah, like, it was like, it kind of threw us for a loop because it was like, oh, okay, so live action. And it's kind of like the same thing that they did with Frozen, where they were talking about, we're working on a live action of Frozen and we have Frozen 3 coming in. And it's like, what the fuck? It's like the anti, you got my peanut butter in my chocolate, you got my chocolate in your peanut butter.
Yeah.
A kind of situation where it's like, no, that's too much.
It is very much like, oh, you like this? We're going to drown you in it. Like, wait, like, no, don't do that. And I get the urge to do the live action Moana because you have The Rock still in his physical prime. Mm-hmm. So you do it when he's still capable of doing it so that you can use him. But also, he doesn't have he does have stardom, but he's not selling like he was selling, you know?
No. And, like, I think, okay, so, like, here's the thing, is that, like, the thing that I took away from Moana 2, and I think I texted you this, was I was like, after doing a bunch of shit and reverting himself back to the pebble, he, you watch this movie, and just the voice, the vocal work alone is enough to make you go, man, this is the Dwayne Johnson I want. I don't want the Pebble from Redone and all the other bullshit he's been doing. What the fuck? And then it makes you mad because it's like, you know, DJ has this thing where, like, it forced me down a rabbit hole of like, okay, so what have I really loved in DJ's career? Like, what is the thing that I love? And the thing I love is either I loved his supreme, like, his supremacy in WWE is unmatched, right? Like, maybe Cena. Like, I would put him above even, like, maybe Cena, actually Undertaker, but I'm not going to talk about Undertaker because it leads to a very rabbity hole bullshit of bullshit, right? Yeah. Like, there's everybody has their Mount Rushmore of wrestling, right?
And he's, I mean, I don't think Cena has it's a different success, but The Rock's is like Hogan times two,
or because maybe like three. He, it's like him and the Giant put together, him and Andre put together, like,
and he The Rock went on to have a successful career outside of that. Like, it,
yes.
I don't know that outside of John Cena, but again, I feel like John Cena's it's a little different. I don't know if anybody in professional wrestling has had the multi-level success that The Rock has had. My dog is being extra today. I'm sorry.
No, it's all good.
It's actually Ripley's Gacha Day. Today is our one-year anniversary, and I think she knows it and is just like, why aren't you paying attention to me? Because this day is special.
Where is my raw steak? Where is my grainies? Where are my walks? but yeah, like back to DJ, what I love most about what in his film career, it wasn't the badassery it was the charm and the magnetism he brought, yep. right? And
go back to not his first movie, which is the Scorpion King stuff, but
oh god,
go to yeah,
The Rundown, yeah,
The Rundown works not because The Rock is a badass, it works because he's so incredibly charming.
Yes, and he's coupled with a lead that is equally charming and in a completely different way and bugs the shit. Like, he is, like, for better or for worse, I feel like DJ, like, I don't think he understands that he's not Bugs Bunny. He's Daffy Duck. But to me, I relate more to Daffy on a spiritual level than I do Bugs, because who the fuck is Bugs? Bugs is so annoying, right? But when he gets a good Bugs, like Kevin Hart, right, who needles him, it brings something out in him that's like, it makes you like him even more, because it's like, it's a different kind of charm than the rascally rabbit, right? In his best movies, that's what we get from him. Or when he's just allowed to, like when he allows himself to be unfettered, just confidence, right? Not like trying to be whatever he's trying to be in Redone or Hercules or Skyscraper or San Andreas. Like,
I think he's fun in Pain and Gain. Like, I think he's,
oh my God,
like leaning into that kind of jockishness of everything.
The stupidity yeah. there, the lunkheadedness, not the I am the superhero. And I think Moana 2 reminded me of the fact that I was like, you know what? This is the DJ you want. Like, this is not the Pebble. Like, I refer to him as the Pebble when he does the things that I feel like Vince would want him to do. That's honest. Like yeah. I look at that and I go, I look at every decision that he's done in the recent memory, in the last like since the second Jumanji movie, after that, I feel like he's lost his way. Like, it yeah. just doesn't make sense to me. And this reminded me, like, they wrote it right and he performed it like the way that you would expect Dwayne Johnson in the era before to perform it. So it's like he's a supporting role in the movie, like he was in the first one, but it's the pop of it. And the way that they kind of rechange his role to go from like antagonist, sort of like the agent of chaos, to like this mentor friend of Moana, and the way they write it, it's one of the best things about the movie. Like, the two things that I took away from the movie, it's not Moana. It's nowhere near Moana. And these two TikTokers that they got to hire to write the music, it shows. I'm sorry, but you know, some people can be musically talented and be influencers, and I know that. But these two, I'm not going to spend too much time dogging on them, but like, you can tell that this is not Lin-Manuel's, like, and this suffers. Moana 2 suffers from the lack of Lin-Manuel Miranda. Mm-hmm. They really should have paid whatever money he wanted. I know why he's not there. He's not there because he's actually working very, very, very creatively and on set for the live action, because the live action movie, from what I understand, has a huge budget. So they're putting all their eggs into that basket. And
so do you think that this was originally just going to be a Disney Plus thing? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And after kind of what's his name coming back in, and the like lean back towards, we've got to have theatricality, we've got to have those movies in theaters, butts in seats, that's where the money like really is, and then, you know, that'll drive them back to Disney Plus when their kids want to watch it again and again and again, but we have to have it in theaters. And so in November of last year, it was, yeah, Moana 2 in theaters next year. Rather than like, oh, surprise, it's coming to Disney Plus.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing is that, like, the thing that I kept on thinking about was when I was listening to it, I was like, why the fuck didn't you get the Andersons? Why, like, you have them in house. Why didn't you, like, if, like, to me, Moana is one of your flagships, right? So if you're going to do a sequel.
Of the last few years, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you understood that, like, but this reeks of Disney Plus, like, decision making, because Lin-Manuel goes away. Like, the thing that you do is you get the Andersons, because they're POCs. And also, like, the thing is that they understand musicality the same way that Lin-Manuel does, right? And yeah. how awesome of a kick in the pants would Moana be is if it was in the hands of, like, like, the Andersons are like the Shermans. They are quickly becoming, like, amazing, like, legendary, like, songwriters that are coming into things that you don't expect them to and just killing it, right? Like, I mean, we just saw something this month. Like, literally this month and last month, we saw the rise of Agatha All Along, and that's basically a showcase for them. If you don't, like, between Catherine Hahn and the cast and the Andersons, that's the reason why you watch that show. So that's a huge hit. Like, I'm going to tell you, there is no song in there, even the Beyond song that they're pushing, man, that fucking feels like an outtake from Frozen. Like, it literally does not sound like a, like, you know how, like, Moana has that, like, what's the one, How Far I'll Go, you know how, like, that's a bang.
Yeah.
And, like, how, like, every little kid cried their eyes out. They didn't know why they cried their eyes out, but they cried their eyes out when they saw that first song.
I'm an asshole. My favorite song in Moana is You're Welcome.
or Shiny, like, yeah. Jermaine singing like as David Bowie and Shiny. I mean, there's so many bangers in that fucking song, in that, like, you could listen to those songs and they'd still be like radio classics without actually knowing that they're from a movie, right? Like, You're Welcome, it just could have been something that fucking The Rock decided to do during the WWE era, right? Like, that's what it seems like, right? Except for it's done with some brass and, you know, How Far I'll Go literally feels like a T-Swift song, right? It feels like Lin-Manuel doing, oh, I'm going to write a T-Swift song. Because if T-Swift sung that song, it would probably be her flagship song, right?
Oh, yeah.
But here, nothing. No imprint. Nothing. Like, even The Rock song. The Rock song is a hype song. It's a hype song for Moana. Like, it's a training montage song. Like, you listen to it, you go, I mean, that's cool, but it's not You're Welcome. And not even close to it. And I solely put, like, the issues I have with this musical solely on Barlow and Bear. Like, first you get two white girls to do a movie about about an Asian Pacific Island, like, you know, character. Like, it's one thing to get a POC like Lin-Manuel, right? Because there's this kind of, like, understanding. But then you get these two white girls to do this stuff. And I'm sorry, but there's no imprint on the songs. Like, and, like, Moana, it's a musical. Like, but, and then on the other side, it's like, but I can't really down it. Like I told you, it's a movie that's like an 8 for a sequel, right? It's not... It doesn't top itself. It kind of goes under, but what it does with the world building is very interesting. Like, the writing for the first time is very interesting in a Disney movie, in a sequel. Like, you know, like, Frozen 2 just kind of reiterates exactly what happens in...
Yeah, there is some stuff in Frozen 2 that does up the game, but it's not plot-wise, it's more character-wise. Where it's just like, oh, shit, like, this is, You know, like I know, like having sisters and nieces, and like one of the things in Frozen 2 that they point to is when he rides in and she's just like, she says something, he goes, "Okay, what can I do to help?" Rather than like trying to dissuade her of like, maybe you're just overreacting, you know, as like, you know, a male coming in and supporting a female character rather than like coming in and like taking over the situation. Like,
Yes.
okay, yeah, I believe you. What can I do to help? There's no like, you know, oh,
There's
you're
no
being
hysteria.
irrational. Yeah.
There's no
So,
yeah.
but to your point, yeah, I think Frozen 2's advancement is all character based and not necessarily. But because honestly, the plot of Frozen 2, I don't know. I don't know. I don't remember the plot of Frozen 2. I remember the character moments, but I do not remember the plot of Frozen 2.
No, absolutely not. And the weirdest part is that I like now a couple of days later, I don't know any of the songs, but I do remember the plot of Moana 2 because it's about the unification of the Pacific Islands. Like that's it's telling the story of like the beginning of the indigenous Pacific Islands and how they all started to connect and how they all started
That's
like mythologically. Like
that's
it's telling the
disappointing because you have a fascinating story to tell that gets undercut by songs that aren't memorable, and you could have had something really cohesive, and instead you've got you know, kind of a half. Yeah.
a discordant movie. Like the story is so good that it elevates it from humdrum musical numbers. Like I'll tell you an example of it is the way they bring back the Kookaburra and the way that the Kookaburra change there, but they don't change. They've never like we've just never heard their story. And like it's wild to say this that you hear the story and then they end up becoming one of the best parts of the movie. Like so much so you get a little kind of like, you know, like in your heart cockles, you get kind of like, oh man, when you hear it's not that you hear their story, it's very kind of like the script does something very well, which is the fact that it treats its characters and its universe with respect. And it expands it in a way that you go, oh, by the mid-credit sequence, because they have a mid-credit sequence in this that announces that they're going to make a third movie, right? It literally is basically like this is like one of those things, right? But it announces it in such a way that you're not mad at it. You're kind of like, oh shit, I want to see this. But then with the kind of like in parentheses, Jesus Christ, get the Andersons or get Lin-Manuel back because we really need great songs to live up to what you guys are doing.
Yeah, it's weird. You do need the great songs because, like, those will. And it's funny because we're arguing about movie musicals, but mostly we were
Yes.
talking about stage adaptations of stage plays, stage musicals. But like the Disney musical model, now that it's come back because they were trying to get away from it for the longest time. Like that, those are the things that sell those. Like as tired as we got of like the music from Frozen or the music from Encanto, that's what sold those to a lot of like, I want to go back and, you know, kids want to go back and see it and then sing along. And then, you know, they like listening to those songs. And like, I mean, that's what it is. So to have not great music, not bad, but not great music, not memorable music, it just undercuts everything. So yeah, you know. You can sell movies like that on a like not complicated plot, But if the thing about it, if you are going to have a complicated plot, Encanto is a big, and I will argue that movie with people that love it. And I'm like, it's so like, it's not that I don't love it, but like I watched it and I was like, wait, these people are toxic. Like they're all toxic. Why don't we talk about Bruno, man? Bruno got a bad rap, and I know that ultimately that's what the movie says, but it's just like, I don't know, man. I don't know if I would have forgiven those people so quick. But you know, having like that complicated plot, if those songs aren't great, that's a really tough sell on a movie, especially repeat viewing for a movie. Like, what gets you the repeat viewings is, oh, I want to listen to those songs. So, because it's a very complicated plot.
Oh, God, yes. And, like, again, like, I'm not trying to be mean about it. Like, I wanted this movie to work, right? Because I love Moana. Like, yeah. Of the new era, Moana is probably my favorite of the movie of the Disney musicals. More than Frozen, more than Frozen 2. And I know I'll get shit for that because there's like, you know, the Frozen Army Nation is fucking like, is strong, right? Like,
so I have such a soft spot in my heart for the first Frozen movie, mainly because of the ending of it and watching it in a theater with all of my nieces and my sister. And like that moment at the end, because they're building up that whole true love thing, which is such a like quote tried and true Disney thing. And then undercutting the expectation of, oh, true love, you know, romantic relationships, and being like, no, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about somebody that truly loves you. Mm-hmm. And having it be the sister bond. Like, it's been so long since that movie came out, and like, I will think about that moment and have to like stop myself because I will get so emotional thinking about it, watching it in a theater with all of those people, just like the end of Toy Story 3. Like, I remember being in the theater with most of my family and just like looking down the aisle and all just of us crying.
Yep. Yep.
But yeah, so, yeah. Moana 2, but I mean, it shows, right? Because it's not, it's going to make money, but it's not doing, nobody's talking. Everybody, we're in Wicked Week 2.
Yeah.
Everybody's talking about Wicked. Nobody's talking about Moana.
Well, so much so that they're already talking about like doing Christmas Day sing-along versions.
Yep.
Of like they're already scheduling it, and my wife is already like, I've already talked to my wife, and she's probably gonna watch that because she wants to like, you know, like she wants that energy. She wants that scream, like that all of the kids all at once and all the parents all at once singing these songs because they've known them, they've lived with them for 20 years, and it's like. It's weird because it's like this is like something to continue on from like our Gladiator conversation about how like you know, the big takeaway from like, I think that we can both agree is that you can't inorganically try to push something to make it a pop culture moment, right? Like you can't make that, no matter how much you try, it's not something that you can do. You can aim for it, but your audience automatically just ends up.
It's got to be completely organic, because otherwise people sniff that stuff out and don't want to be a part of, you know, as much as we like to be sold to, like there are still things as a society we're just like, that feels like you're trying to sell me something, and I'm not buying. So, yeah, it's really, really interesting to like, as somebody who hasn't seen either one of them, to be on the other side of this and watch it and go, huh, this is not how I thought this was going to play out. That's interesting.
Absolutely. No. Like, I didn't think so either. Like, I knew it was going to be big because, I mean, you know, I sniff the air inside of, like, theater kid stuff. And it's like, I mean, not like that, but you know what I mean? Like I'm adjacent to that world, and I like theater. I like musicals. So it's something that I kind of have tracked, but like we were like, you know, you look at the face value of it. Yeah. Moana 2. Like you thought that it was going to be it. Like I, like, it's still going to probably make money. Like it's on track to make a lot of money right now, over the weekend, but it's not like the cultural, like, nuclear bomb that,
what? That's what I thought. Yeah, that's what I thought it was going to be, more in line. This will be like Frozen 2. Maybe not have the well, Frozen 2 didn't have the lasting impact that the first one did, but do that kind of like numbers and everybody still kind of talking about it. But instead, here we are, like, everybody I know is talking about Wicked, and it's like, oh yeah, Frozen 2 came out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's so not to jump back to Wicked, but just do you think that because of the success, I realize that it's probably still in post-production because they filmed them back to back. If everything with the part two is golden, do you think they move up the release date, or do you think, because I don't even know if it's firm yet, is it?
Yeah, next November.
November? Okay.
It's the same time frame. It's the Thanksgiving Day weekend for next year. I think that they won't move it up, if anything. They might move it back to Christmas, but then you also, like, so you have to deal, you have to contend with...
If the Christmas sing-along thing is a success, they would absolutely keep it in November. And then you get not just a double dip on Wicked 2, you get a third bite at the first Wicked, because, or maybe even third and fourth, because you re-release the first Wicked early November for a limited run. Then you then you can do double feature sing-along. Yeah. It's gonna be, you're right, they won't move it up. It'll be way too tempting to, like, just keep taking bites at that apple.
Yeah, and then there's this whole theory that Universal is gonna bring out the olive branch to Warner Brothers because it's been stated by John Chu his dream would be to remake The Wizard of Oz. And if you get the first two and then you kind of do this recontextualization of The Wizard of Oz with the Wicked cast.
So he wants to remake the musical version of Wizard of Oz.
Yes. That's supposedly his dream. I don't know. I haven't done any kind. I've just heard this rumor and hearsay of it, to which, like, that's a bold thing to do, but also I see how that tracks.
Last week I rewatched The Wizard of Oz, and I guess just because Wicked was on the brain, and I just put it on. I didn't sit down and watch it, but I put it on. It was on the background. I can appreciate wanting to do that with the cast. There's some movies that I'm just like, just leave it alone. Like, it.
Yes.
I think The Wizard of Oz, I don't know that you could do anything except fall on your face.
Yep. That's my theory. But also the other theory is that they're actually thinking about, like, doing something that both respects it, but also does something completely different. Like, so basically using the name in name only, like, you know, like you got Wicked Part 2, and then you have, like, Wizard of Oz. Instead of doing The Son of Wicked, which is the book, the sequel book. So anywho, like, I don't know. Like, it's going to be interesting to see how they approach this, because, like, somebody said that Universal was prepared but wasn't prepared for this. Yeah. Like, they were not prepared for, like, so much so that, like, this whole thing of, like, the sing-alongs, the reason why it's going to take until Christmas is because they don't have the space to, they didn't, like, create a sing-along version, because they didn't think that that was going to be something.
Well, and you didn't have that worked out in advance with, like, theaters. You haven't negotiated the screening space, like, all of that. You know, there are still movies coming out that you know, vied for screens world, you know, nationwide, worldwide, whatever. And, like, now you have to kind of recontextualize that, because I mean, AMC, like, the theaters kind of got whiff of it, like, as the tickets started selling, because like, literally day one, like, AMC, Regal, they had signs up, please no singing along with the movie.
Yes. Well, did you hear how that came about? Because people were fucking singing in the trailer. That's how Regal, AMC, all of these places knew that this was something special, because kids and people were literally, when they were singing the sections, the small sections that they had of the musical in the theater. That's how you know, like, if the trailer is doing it, which is the equivalent of, like, our gen going in to see the Phantom Menace trailer.
Yeah, like, doing buying the John Williams music.
Exactly. like, it's so, like, they had a whiff of it, but, you know, it's like one of those things where it's like, like, that's how you know that something organically came about, because it just kind of smacks theaters in the face, and it smacks, like, Universal in the face. Like, I mean, I cannot imagine that Universal isn't like, holy shit, like, we have something on our hands. Can we just put the Wolfman trailer on the fucking Wicked movie? Because they've got gold that they can, they don't know what to do with. I mean, like, here's the thing. There's no trailer or post-credit sequence for part two that tells you how much in advance that they didn't know that what they had. And I guarantee goddamn to you that after the musical version, the way that you're going to be able to see the trailer is go see Wicked part one again, and at the end you'll have Wicked part, like, it won't even be a trailer in the theater, it will be a trailer on the end, a la fucking Back to the Future 2 with Back to the Future 3, right? Like, to bring it back to one of our favorite film series, right? Like, it's going to be one of those things where they tag it on. So you can't just go and buy yourself a fucking ticket for something to see the trailer. You have to go see Wicked a third time. It organically, they've just kind of, like, pushed it, like, so much so that, like, how I kind of get a reconfirmation of this is that they've already set the date, the hard date for the physical media and screen VOD release of Wicked, and it's the end of February 28th and March 14th. So you know that they have something that's long lasting that they want to get through award season, because they're not putting it out like, you know, January 1st or some shit like that. They've already said hardly that the 4K is not going to be out until March 14th. So that's, like, literally 5 months from now. And then the VOD is supposed to be sometime at the end of February.
Which we've had, like, late releases like that for, the Alien Romulus release has been a while coming. And it was a moderate success. Like, it definitely did better than they thought it was going to do. For hugely successful. I mean, Deadpool Wolverine was 3 months.
3 months.
Almost doubling that for a successful movie, like, in this day and age, it feels really, really weird. But I mean,
you can tell, like, that. Yeah. That, kind of hands that they're already seeing. Like, it's not greed. It's literally like I was thinking about it. And I was like, it's a little greed, but it's also like understanding that this is a theatrical experience. And
I mean, I'm here for it. Like, I miss that kind of, it is nice to be able to like, oh, I can stream it whenever, but you know, it is kind of nice to have that little bit longer legs, and it just, yeah, it doesn't happen anymore, you know? I'm excited for what this could mean. I'm also worried for what other studios might take away from it, you know? And yeah, because they never take the right lesson. They always take the lesson of, like, I mean, superhero movies are a good example. A lot of studios just took the lesson of like, oh, people want to see superhero movies. No, that's not really what they, even Marvel fell victim, are like, oh, people just see whatever we put out. No, you still got to make it good. So
yeah. You still have to make a great movie. Like, that's the whole thing, is like, that's the thing that I take away from this always. This is that if you, like, Universal was smart because they left them alone and they gave them a ginormous budget. And they used the budget properly. It's like the other thing that I don't like that we haven't even talked about is the fact that the movie is debt bound in a way that I don't think anybody is ready for. Like, when you watch it, it is not a CGI nonsense mess. Like, the CGI that's done, man, they took their time with it. It looks, it's gorgeous. Like, but like many of the, like I'd say 90% of what you see on screen, with the exception, like, and the 1% is like literally like, I don't know, like transitional stuff. But most of it is set bound, like the Munchkin Land, the Shaw's, which is like the school that they go to, even the Emerald City, are all stages, like literally ginormous stages. Like, there's moments in these musical numbers where Chu gets to do what he does best, which is like his, it's not a style trope for him, like uniquely him, but what he does is he's allowed these long Broadway takes, and the way that he does it makes, like, he really does understand production design, and the fact that you want to know that it's real sets.
Yeah,
like,
that's one of the things about movie musicals, that the cutting, the mm-hmm. editing, it takes away from the special feeling of what, like, when you're watching them on stage, that's all you're watching, the take. There is no like, oh, I flub. So like those long takes with no cuts in movie musicals are really special. Like, when you can do that, that's something really, really special. Like, yeah. Even if you can tell that, like, okay, well, they're singing, but like it's overdubbed with like actual like in booth recording of the song, that's mm-hmm. fine. It's just those, and the best ones, that's what they have, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you're gonna have cuts, but like, you want yeah. those long wide shots, and yeah, it that makes me happy that stuff like that's in there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it, like I said, it's a banger. Like, it, like, I was not, like, on my bingo card, I was not expecting it to be a top five, maybe even top three, like, movie of the year. Like, that's the kind of, like, level of skill, care, passion, performance, and artistry that this movie has, like, come out with. And I mean, but if you look back on it, it is not shocking. Like, if you think about it, it's like, I was like, okay, so, yeah, you, like, from the beginning, they did smart casting. Cynthia Erivo, like, I have nothing but praise for that woman. Her voice is like a godsent piece of sunshine that, like, you just cannot deny. Ariana Grande, I've had conflicted feelings about her, but I will say this much. She is as much as Kristen Chenoweth is Galinda, she is as much Galinda as Chenoweth is. And it's perfect. Like the casting is perfect. Goldblum is perfect. The dude who plays Fierro, I can't think of his name, Mr. Bridgerton, one of the Bridgertons, he's great. And then the cameos that they have, like Dinklage plays the goat professor. He's like, you can't even tell it's Dinklage because of the voice that they do. But then once you find out that it is Dinklage, you're like, oh shit, that's Peter Dinklage that's playing that role. That's fucking great. It's that kind of it's the kind of care and time, and it's like you don't think about it, but you go, oh yeah, absolutely. Shooting on set, spending the money to do that, this is a movie that will lose something. You know how Oppenheimer lost something? I don't know if you've watched it on home video, but it loses something.
After seeing it in IMAX, it is one of those things that's I saw it in real IMAX. I don't know that I can watch this at home because it's not going to have the same effect. I could, catch bits and pieces of it here and there, but it's going to lose something on the small screen.
Exactly. And I can already tell you when you see it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. There is a cinematic language that, like you said, like the medium shot, that doesn't translate to any place but a big 50-foot screen, right?
Yeah.
Like the medium shot, the full body shot, the wide screen that it plays with and it uses, it's going to lose something on screen, on the small screen. Like, it just literally...
That's when it becomes the... I did with The Wizard of Oz. It becomes, you become familiar with it and it becomes the background, which isn't a bad thing, but it becomes the background and not the sit down and marvel at it kind of thing. So
yes.
I'm going to have to make the time to go see this, and I'll report back. I doubt I'll have a different reaction than Adam. But I don't know. We've disagreed on a few things.
But even then, let's be honest. I said up front, I was it's a messy fucking movie. It's a really messy movie.
Yeah.
It's not I'm not saying it's a great movie. Not by any means. I enjoyed it a lot more than the
experience, not necessarily the movie. So if it doesn't feel 2.5 hours, then I'll be happy, because holy shit, Gladiator felt 3.5 hours.
So also just one last thing for you, when I sat down for the whole thing, no bathroom break. I'm usually this is a dirty secret about me, is that I usually take a bathroom break midway through a film. Even if it's a 90 minute movies, no, but anything over 2 hours, I'm usually headed into the head at a certain point.
Yeah.
Because it's just too long, man. You drink your soda and shit. This is a movie where we drank a large soda, had popcorn, and I still managed to sit through the entirety of the fucking movie. That's how riveting and an experience it is, because you just don't want to miss anything. I think that that's the biggest compliment I can give the movie, is that it sat me down, shut me the fuck up, and not forced me, but drew my attention from the opening.
Not wanting to leave. That's a big thing for me, especially for long movies. I have not watched much of anything this week. I did watch a show that we're hopefully going to talk about soon, because
I think next week we will, because that's on my.
You gotta see it, man. I'm going to rewatch it, and not in a way that I rewatch The Office. I'm gonna rewatch it in a way that I rewatch Ted Lasso, And I like, I need something to make me feel good. Cause it's fucking, it's not the best thing he's ever done. It's not the best thing any of the people involved in this show have ever mm-hmm. done. It's called Man on the Inside. It's on Netflix. Everybody should just go watch it now. But it is the, like, I don't know. It's hard to describe. We'll talk about it when you watch it. Like, mostly.
Have you seen? Oh, go ahead.
You go ahead.
I was going to ask, did you see? Okay, so like Man on the Inside is actually based on a very charming documentary called The Mole, El Agente. Yeah.
It's on Netflix too. I'm going to watch that. I hope to watch that maybe today. And then rewatch the show.
Okay.
So
because I have seen the documentary. It was one of those things that I was like, oh, let's take a look at this. And it was just utterly charmed by it.
Yeah.
So Man on the Inside, I am very, very, very much so looking forward to. It is probably on deck for our next binge because it's only 8 episodes and it's all available. And I mean, of course, like Logan said, it's Michael Schur. So like I think that like, if anything, you learned anything. I mean, about...
we could do a whole episode just on this guy and his work.
Yes.
Which we may wind up doing next week. I have done a couple of other things. I've been reading this book for a little while, but now I'm to a point where I can't put it down. And it's funny because we talked about the show a couple of years ago, The Outsider, on the HBO show based on the Stephen King book. And the show was just fantastic. I started reading the book because I've been making my way through the Holly Gibney stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is the next piece in building up to reading Holly and then the new Holly book that's coming out in 2025 and the possible show that's coming in 2025. We'll see. Holy shit. Look, I mean, we've not made any bones about the fact that I'm a Stephen King person and I mostly read Stephen King books, even though I haven't read all his stuff. He is great at the horror stuff. Really, really great. And this ultimately is a horror novel. It becomes a supernatural horror thing. But it doesn't become that until... I think the show, you realize, like, after the first or second episode, that, oh, this has this supernatural twinge to it. And if you didn't know that about the book going in, you wouldn't know what was coming because it's over halfway through the book that it really, really leans into the supernatural. And I know we've talked about this before. This man, I won't say he missed his calling, but he should have been writing
crime,
like for a thriller, long time. Crime thrillers.
Yeah.
It's like fucking riveting. Man, the first 250 pages of this book, it's just like, it's so good. And all it is this impossible crime of like, this man is accused of murdering and molesting this boy. And they discover he was in two places. Like, how was that? And it's less about solving that mystery and more about the effect that it's having on everybody's life. And it's so just, it's so good. And so I'm a little over halfway. Holly just came. She doesn't even come into the story until halfway. It's been absolutely thrilling. And I can't wait to get into Holly, which a friend of mine just finished. And she's like, it's so good. It's so good.
No, absolutely. Like, I've read The Outsider. I've not. So that's the only that's the only Holly Gibney book that I've read, and I didn't even read it as a I didn't even read it because of Holly. I just read it because it's Stevie. Like the thing that I like, I'd read the elevator pitch on the thing, and I was like, oh, okay, well, King and this, fuck yeah. Like, I love when King goes outside of his wheelhouse and tries to do something. And crime is something that, like, he always has been around. I mean, he, like, you read his reviews on EW. Like, I will tell somebody, like, if anybody wants a reason why to watch The Wire, read his, like, 5-season, like, review of The Wire, and it will convince you. And then it will also convince you that this man loves crime fiction as much as he loves horror.
Yeah.
And this book is like the mashing of it, because it is a hard horror, like it is a hard crime novel at the beginning, like until Holly shows up, because they are all like, I love the structure of this book because it gets you to a point to where you're like, holy, like, because it grounds it so hard. And yeah. Then by the time
and you realize halfway through the book that less than a week has passed.
Yes, but it's so emotionally trying on people. It feels like it's years for everybody, including you. And when she finally, like when Howie, I think, isn't it Howie or is it Alec that hires Holly? I
can never remember. Alec. Through, well, yeah, it's him because he knew Bill. And yeah. Bill Hodges, her former partner, who the Hodges trilogy, which I just finished a month and a half, 2 months ago, which is where Holly came from. Excellent, excellent series of crime thriller tinged with supernatural, and also very well adapted as the Mr. Mercedes three-season television series. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fantastic. If you can find it, definitely worth watching and reading. He calls Bill because he knew that Bill was working kind of as an investigator. But they've been so out of touch, he doesn't know Bill died years ago. And so she kind of weasels her way into it because the guy's just like, I'm sorry he passed. I hate to hear that. I'll find somebody more local, because she's in like, the Northeast, and this takes place in Oklahoma. But she kind of weasels her way into it, starts doing the investigating and uncovering, a lot of weird coincidences that make her think that something supernatural is at play. And what's interesting is, like, so you didn't read the Hodges stuff. So no. Part of the draw to have Holly in this story, even though it's mostly it's a character that he created that he can't, like, not that he can't let go of, he's spoken about it as if like he can't stop thinking about this character, and like
he's good.
It's so he's become his new Roland, basically, but more grounded, real world. But Holly coming into this, so that the Hodges stuff ends on an interesting supernatural thing that doesn't really work, but it's okay. Like it works well enough. So she has some experience with supernatural stuff. Everything else in the book is so grounded in reality that those characters keep saying, this is impossible, that the boogeyman doesn't exist. None of this, like, they can't believe it. Her coming into it and having that experience, like, especially if you've had it with her, it eases that transition into the more supernatural stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And makes it a little bit easier to swallow, more palatable. So it's kind of the best thing to have her in this story, especially if you've been following her journey. But yeah, it is an absolutely riveting fucking book. And I loved the show. I thought it was very well done, and I hadn't read the book. And so, like, I put off reading the book long enough to just be like, well, I mean, the show was so well done. Like, why, like, you know, why bother with the book? And now I'm just like, it's that the Harry Potter thing you were talking about, where like, this book is excellent, the show was excellent, and they're not the same, but they are. Yes. And yeah, it is the Holly Gibney stuff is gonna go down probably for me. Like, I get the Dark Tower, it's great. Mm-hmm. I think it's uneven as hell. But I get why everybody loves it. His best stuff is the Bill Hodges, Holly Gibney stuff. I have no qualms about saying that. That, like, all of this stuff that I've read, yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. And it's all been well adapted so far. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do going forward. The other thing I've been doing is playing video games. I finished Miles Morales, which I should have done before I played Spider-Man 2. I didn't. I went back and played Miles. I didn't play it because I thought it was just like this half-assed, what should have been like a download for Spider-Man 1. I was like, oh, this is just like, I'm going to pay them $50 for a game that I could beat in a day, and which you can beat it in a day. But it is a full-on, like, impressive experience. The ending is way more emotional than I expected it to be.
Yes.
Like, his relationship with the Tinker, and like dealing with all the Harlem stuff, and his mom,
and the Prowler.
It's so good.
It's a great fucking game. It's smaller, but man, like, the heart in that game, like, that's what I was hoping that eventually you would get to it. Because it is a small game. It's not a slight game. It's just a smaller scale game. But man, does it?
I think it has more heart than the Miles stuff is more heartfelt than any of the Peter stuff for me.
Oh, definitely.
So, and maybe it's just because we know those stories so well. Like, I mean, the Doc Ock stuff. Like, it's great, but like, we've seen that emotional apex. We saw it in Spider-Man 2. Nothing's ever gonna top that, man. So,
but I'm glad that you enjoyed it. Did you 100% it, or are you?
No. I've been playing it on the weekends for a couple of weeks now. Okay. I'm probably gonna go. I might do that this weekend, like, go back and, you know, do all the things I've missed. There's some stuff you can't even do until you beat the game. There's two side missions you can't do until you beat the game. So I'll probably finish that up this weekend. I don't know if I'll get like all the achievements and everything, but I'll unlock all the suits and all that stuff. I think there's only two suits I haven't unlocked. Maybe three. There's one you can unlock until you beat the game, and then there's two I just didn't have the whatever the points, whatever it is you got to accumulate. I didn't have enough, so I'll have to go back and do a few things to unlock those suits. But no big deal. I could probably spend the rest of my life just playing Spider-Man 1, Miles Morales, and Spider-Man 2 and be happy. So, but I texted you yesterday. I did find Walmart had a Black Friday deal. Nobody had in-store Blu-ray deals. Walmart's the only person that really sells Blu-rays anymore. Oh. But they didn't have a single in-store Blu-ray thing. They were so disappointing. But they did have Tears of the Kingdom for $30, which is damn near about half off. So a friend of mine at work has been playing it. She just started playing it and she's been raving about it. I'm like, yeah, I can't play it because it'll take over my life. And I found it for $30. I have been vehemently like, I'm not buying this game. But for damn near half off, I could not buy the game. I texted her. I was like, just so you know, I'll be turning in my 2-week notice on Monday, and this is going to be my life from now on, just playing this game. She thought that was funny. But, yeah, I don't know when I'm going to start it. I really don't.
I can completely understand that, because the last time we talked about this, you went into a deep dive of
Breath of the Wild, and just for 3 months, like for the first month or so, it was like, oh, I'll play here or there. But by the last month I was playing that game, it was like all I did was play that game. Like, I'd put something on and I'd play the game while I was, quote, watching something, which means I'm not really watching it. I was still working from home. And, you know, I mean, nobody I work with listens to this. I was working from home. I wasn't working. I was playing Breath of the Wild and just, like, moving my mouse every few minutes. So, like, it was rough. And so I'll probably have to limit myself, because I can't get that deep into a game. If I hadn't accidentally wandered into the final stage of the first one, I don't know when I would have ever put it down, like, because I kept putting off beating Ganon because there were so many other things I wanted to explore. So, and I was exploring the castle, and I just happened to wander into, like, what triggered the final boss. I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm doing this. But I had leveled up everything so much that the final fight was not even that, like, it wasn't that difficult. The other game I have been playing a lot of, which I also got at Walmart a few weeks ago for like $20. I've never played a Kirby game, which is weird because I've been gaming casually gaming as long as Kirby's been around, essentially.
Yeah.
Never played a Kirby. The only time I played as Kirby is in like Super Smash Brothers or something. I got Kirby Return to Dreamland, Kirby and Dreamland was one of the early like Game Boy Kirby games, I think.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
This game is utterly fucking charming and fun, easy to play. Levels take 3-4 minutes. If you just speed run through them, there's little things you can get. It's absolutely worth the $20 I paid for it. I think probably regular price is probably $40 or $50. I don't know how I got it for $20. It's wonderful. It's bright. It's fun. It's funny. You can get, like, if you know Kirby, you know, he like eats everything, and like certain enemies that you eat, you gain their abilities. And so like every new little like enemy you come across, it becomes like this, like, ooh, what is this power going to be? Mario Wonder, it is like, if you played that, it has a similar kind of like fun feel to it. and the levels being super short. There's all these little bonus games that you unlock. It's really expansive for a game that doesn't require a lot of skill to play. It's definitely one of those that feels aimed at a younger audience because the levels aren't super complicated and you don't have to do anything too tricky. I've only played through like three of the worlds, but it's such a fun game to play for just a few minutes and then you can just put it down. Which are my favorite kind of games to play. That's been, other than watching Man on the Inside, that's pretty much what I've been doing, and watching Shrinking, which finally brings us to Shrinking. I've been current on Shrinking since the season started. You played catch up this week.
Yes, over the last week and a half, I've definitely played catch up, and did Lawrence and company really want to make a challenging season for us? Like, it is. So,
spoilers,
like,
for Shrinking, but yeah. Holy shit, it is. The first season is emotional, but this season, like, watching them not just still come to terms with the death of this character, this woman that intertwined their lives, but confronting the person that did it is...
Oh, man. Yeah.
You watched this week's, right?
Fucking fine. Huh? Oh, yeah. Okay. I watched it last night, and wow, did we need to, like, we did a palate cleanse and we watched some stupid, like, Christmas, like, fucking Christmas movie, Netflix Christmas movie, because, man, like, the thing is that it's challenging, but it also is draining, but it manages to be so, like, it manages to juggle tone so nicely that, like, so kind of, like, I don't even know how to do, like, to talk about it. Like it balances that tone between dark and light in a way that, like, no show has done before. Like, I mean, it that whole opening moment where they go back 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus Christ. Like, not only do you feel empathy for everybody, but you all, like, you know, everybody that's you're already in your cast with, but like the Brett Goldstein character as well, because you find out, like, what I love about the show and the thing that, like, I always take away from it is there is never a point where it tells you a conventional version of what you think is the story. Like, never do you get the easiest answers. And good grief. I can't describe
the idea that. And it's kind of always a thing in Bill Lawrence shows that there is, like, you're not coming across a villain.
Yeah.
Even if it's easy to understand that they are the villain of that story, you're coming across somebody who, that guy had the worst day of his entire life.
Yep. The worst day of his entire life. And
because, unfortunately, it made it the worst day of your entire life, too.
Yeah. And not just, like, the thing that is so beautiful about the show, and this is what Lawrence does so well, is it's the chaos theory. It's like the it's the Ian Malcolm, like, You throw a rock into a pond, and the ripple effect of that particular action, and, like, you get to see the moment where everything changes, and it's like the way that it's done is done so unimportantly, but there are couples that have had that exchange of, well, I've only had two drinks, and I didn't even, this is my second drink. Let's go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
You've drunk way too much, and it's a simple choice. And, like, if the show does anything, if it makes people go, I need to get an Uber. Like, they think about that moment and they go, fuck it, I'm going to get an Uber. This show has done its job, because, like, the thing that I noticed the most about this show is that it very purposely shows what happens when you make bad decisions, right?
I mean, not even just that relationship, right? Like, you're seeing it in other things. Like, Krista Miller's relationship with her husband on the show. It's like,
God,
watching that unfold and seeing the responsibility that both sides play in those things.
That's the hardest one to have watched. Like, I know it sounds weird, but that relationship and the downward spiral that it happens was the hardest one to watch, because, like, you told, like you didn't prepare me, and thank you for not preparing me for, like, the trauma that relationship goes through. And, like, good God, Ted McKnight, give him the best supporting actor, Emmy right now, because the way that he approaches it, like, I don't even know, dude, like, I can't even talk about it. Like,
Derek, like, as a character, it's so beautifully written, is so,
yeah.
He's beautiful, he's wonderful, but also, so, like, he goes to, I mean, the short version of, if you're not watching the show, Krista Miller, his wife, I'm drawing a blank on her character's name, her husband's Ted McGinley, and he is very supportive of his wife, and, like, you see that, yes. And she's so kind of, like, playfully shitty with him, and he just, you know, shrugs his shoulders, and, like, it's this relationship that you're like, oh, I guess it works, but, like, they both have things going on in their lives that their significant others should be more aware of and, you know, kind of addressing. And he hasn't been present for her. And especially in her leaning into this art thing with her photography. Yeah, and he's just been very dismissive of it. Not in a shitty way, just in a, like, oh, that's your thing, honey. And just not, like, so she ran into an old flame. They kiss. She comes clean about it, like, pretty soon afterwards, like, the next day.
Yeah.
Owns up to it, tells him, he kind of loses it, leaves, then goes to confront this guy who he knows, and just, like, it doesn't have that moment of, like, we're going to be, you know, absolutely shitty to each other. It's like the best of humanity. It's like what we hope we would be in that situation. You know, like, having those difficult conversations and then not coming to, like, I'm going to kick your ass. It's saying, I very much want to kick your ass right now for everything that happened. How dare you make a move on my wife? But also being understanding of, like, okay, I wasn't present for her. Because this guy hung up her pictures in his bar. Yeah.
Played by, and the guy who, Mac, terrible fucking name, shittiest name, played by Josh Hopkins, another Bill Lawrence alumni from Cougar Town, who, let's be honest, like, there's a way to play this, and he doesn't play it as the dirtbag, which he totally could have, but he
does. But you get that he is a dirtbag, but it's not played as, like, oh, yeah, kiss your wife. What are you going to do about it? It's just like, he's very much like, yeah, man, like,
she is
losing her was a mistake. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, her name is Liz, by the way. He even says that he's like Liz is the one that got away. And he's like, you are the luckiest man in the world. And it doesn't justify it, but it definitely gives you context. Like, it allows you to go, I don't like you, and I don't like what you did, but you know what? You're a human being, and you cannot say that if you lost the love of your life that you wouldn't try to get her back. Like that's the thing. Like, it doesn't make anybody at fault. Like, that's the most wonderful thing about this show, is that it finally, I finally find a show where, like, something that's, like that's almost cheating. I mean, it is, right? It's a trespass, a physical trespass on your relationship. But it doesn't treat it like one person is the fucking whore and one person is the sterling, modicum of,
Or the flip of that. It shows both sides, which is one of the things that he's really, really good at. I think like I was just saying, the way everybody does react to these situations is not, it's the way we wish we would react. It's not real life. It's not real. Like Ted Lasso, like the betrayals in the final season of, or the season, end of season two and most of season three of Ted Lasso are, none of us would react like Ted. Most of us would react like Beard. Mm-hmm. And you do get to see both sides of that, but I don't think any of us ever even get to where Beard gets to with Nate of that forgiveness. No. Like, we're shitty people. Like, just by and large, we're shitty. Humans are shitty.
Well, you know what? We're Jimmy. Like, we are Jimmy. If anything this year I have both loved and it's challenged me is Jimmy's situations, because it never, like, the thing that I love most, but it also kind of makes me draw back, is Jimmy's reactions to things are so fucking human, are so us, but then everybody else judges him and makes him feel like shit for the decisions he makes, but it's absolutely the reason, what everybody should be doing, because it's almost like
it's what we would do. Even when he confronts Brett Goldstein, the man who was drunk driving and killed his wife, his twice now he's come face to face with him, and the first time, very, very human reaction, completely understand it. The second time, I think that's how most of us would, quote, forgive somebody. Forgive. Like, mm-hmm. I forgive you. I don't ever fucking want to see you again. It's still not real. It's not real. Yeah. It's not real. You're doing that so you can go back to your daughter and your friend and be like, okay, I forgave him. And now we're done with this. We're moving on. I want to forget this part of my life ever happened, that I had to see this man's face again twice, or three times, really. But you're still holding on to all of that hurt. So it is still, you're still poisoning your own well. And you're right. That is ultimately what 90%+ of us do. You know, we might say, oh, we forgive you, but I forgive you, but only if I never fucking see you again. And it's not that I forgive you, it's that I want to forget you ever existed. So, person in general.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That has his own pain and his own trauma, but also, it's the most, man, my heart, literally, I've never had this happen to me in a film, in a TV series, but literally, you know that feeling that you get when, you're in a free fall? That moment when he says that, it was literally a free fall moment for me. My heart went into my stomach, because it was the most human piece of interaction I've seen on a TV series or a film in a long time. There's two moments in this episode that felt like that. it was that moment. And man, I had to hold back the tears at the end of the episode with Jimmy and Paul, like their moment where they share the whiskey. Yeah. But when Jimmy like confides to him and like fucking bored, man, like this season, if it's anything, he deserves like all of the praise. I wish this was a movie because it would give him his Oscar that he so rightfully deserves.
And he's another one. Like we're only getting glimpses of like his personal life and his past, but we have over the two seasons for sure. Like in season one, there was the strange relationship with his daughter and telling her that he has Parkinson's and like dealing with all of that. And in this, it's like you get the glimpse behind the reason for the estrangement. And like he was not faithful to his wife, her mother, and like the reasons for all, which is interesting because like you have kind of held this man up, like put him on a little bit of a pedestal once you start in season one, and slowly like he's moved down a notch, but weirdly that makes him like a much more compelling character. Like it's this idea of like we're all, like I said, we're all shitty people and we've all done shitty things. And it's about forgiving, truly forgiving others, forgiving yourself. Like Jimmy says, like, ultimately, he's really just angry at himself.
Yep. And he wants, like, that's the moment that hit me so fucking hard, which was, he's like, I hope I can forgive myself. And then Paul just saying, like, and you could tell, like, he wants to say more, but knows he can't. And he goes, I hope so too. And it's like, that's what Ford is good at. Mountains of emotion behind that one moment. And them both knowing that Jimmy may not ever get there, but he hopes he does. Like, and he can't say that to him, even though, like, you know, he wants to help Jimmy so badly, but he knows that just like himself, like, this is a road and a journey that he has to go on himself, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like what happens with Paul with his attack, right? When he's at home and we see him and he says, like, I'm having a bad day. I think I should go. And she, like, his girlfriend tells him, well, I'm do you want me to go? And he goes, no, I kind of don't want you to go, but I'm having a bad day. And then it's that simple moment of her like letting him lay on her chest and kind of be vulnerable. Right. Yeah. And he doesn't know how to be vulnerable, but then he's like, he knows he needs somebody to go with him. Right. And so he picks the most inappropriate person, but the most appropriate person, you know, in Brian or not Brian,
Sean.
And they go, and it's like, even watching him, like, it's the whole thing of, like, trying to get, like, it's like Paul and Jimmy are, like, two sides of an equation of, like, what the real human experience is like. And everybody else has, like, this wonderfully perfect, coiffed, like, most of the time they have a perfectly coiffed, like, response to things. But what I like about this season is that everybody has, like, a 2-degree separation of reality and, like, fantasy. Like, even Gabby with her, the whole thing with her mother and her sister, like, that's a really fucking shitty thing to do to somebody who's your fucking sister, and trying to punish them over an addiction that they probably didn't have very much of a choice in, even though, like, she's made her, like, and she's made her fucking penance, right? It's
here's this, the thing though, I've been in that, or I currently am in that situation. I have a sister who is still very actively in her addiction, who has who abandoned her family, abandoned her own children for that. And so, like, I look at that situation and I completely understand where she's coming from. Cause even if my sister, like, went through recovery, got clean, like, got really back involved in her children's lives, like, all of that stuff, and was doing the thing she's supposed to do, I really don't. I think I'd react like that. I'd still be Absolutely. Holding her accountable for the things that she did previously, even though she's making amends, even though she is sorry. Like, I understand that. I'd be like, you know what? Like, it never ends. But yeah. the flip side of that is, like, you look at that situation and be like, she's making amends, like, but she does need to, like, be able to move on with her life as well, and you're holding her hostage essentially to all of those things in the past, and that is a shitty thing to do when somebody's actively sorry and, you know, done all the things that they need to try to do to make amends, and you're just like, okay, that's great, but like, you still did those things. Like, I don't mm-hmm. forgive you for those things. And, like, it's... Like I said, this show does a wonderful job of presenting both of those sides. And...
Yeah.
Just showing that. Sean and his dad is another great example.
God. Well, it's Sean this entire series. This entire season. Like, with... Like Sean being who he is and imploding and self-imploding, but also like having a support system. I mean, I think that that's kind of like one of the bigger like takeaways from this season for me is that A, it's an Empire season. Like, I think I texted that to you. I was like, Jesus Christ, this is like the Empire Strikes Back of shrinking. But also, it very much talks about the support systems we have and we don't have, right? Like, because one of the big opposing forces in this show is how it shows how some people have support systems that they either reject or accept. But then also we get to very much see, like with Lewis, who has no support system, but who has rejected it because of the guilt he feels over a split second decision that, and this tells you how good of a human being he is and how fucked up we are as humans, is he takes that and uses that as responsibility. And he thinks that like by not allowing his girlfriend, who a big shout out, like my wife actually pointed it out to me. I was like, holy shit, it is.
She's become a Bill Lawrence staple.
Yes, which if she never leaves Bill Lawrence's like universe, please, like have her on Ted Lasso. Like she is such a wonderful discovery and so different in this show. And she fucking breaks your heart. Like Brett Goldstein breaks your heart in the moment where you know what he's going to do and why he does it. But the way that she plays that moment of utter devastation, because like, it's not like other shows where it's like, oh, she's saying this, but she really doesn't mean it. Like, she actually means it. She wants to be there. Like, this is the love of her life, and she's losing the love of her life for like what she thinks is like an acceptable amount of time. And then when he's just like, no, we can't do this. I can't ever do this. I want you to be happy. And not realizing that her happiness is him. Like, that's some complicated, wild shit in a comedy. Like, I don't think that there was any other show that could have handled it the way that it does, other than a Bill Lawrence show, another Bill Lawrence show, whatever it is. But it's also about, like, pushing away support systems, right? And what happens when we push those away? I mean, I know in my life I've done that a number of times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You just like wallow in your own self-pity, you know. Yeah. Maybe he's not wrong. He can't forgive himself for what he did. And every time he looks at her, all he's going to think about is, I had one too many drinks one night. We were having a good time. And then I drunkenly killed somebody. And you're a reminder of that. And I do want to wallow in the guilt, but I also want to forget that it ever happened. And, you know, not that he blames her, but like it, you know, will become a point of this animosity. And yeah, it's such like complex shit. And it's handling it so well. Like the glimpses of like real humanity and like how we would really react are great, but like it's also nice to have like things to aspire to, you know?
Yes.
But, no, much absolutely. Like the Ted Lasso, like I want to react the way Ted reacts. I don't want to react necessarily the way Beard reacts, but seeing those disparate things and knowing like, okay, this is how I would react, but seeing somebody be more responsible is, but then like you also have like Alice, who has been like rightfully so hard on her dad and the way he handled the death and how he basically abandoned her, but then something happens with her and she immediately betrays her best friend.
Absolutely.
In the shittiest fashion.
Oh, God, yes. Like, she is Jimmy's daughter in a way that, like, she is more Jimmy's daughter than she is Tia's daughter. Like, you know, like you can tell. Like, it's like this thing of, like, it's weird because you, like, the more we're getting a picture of who Tia was as a person, and who Jimmy is, and also who Alice is, like, you can tell that Alice is never Tia. She was always Jimmy. And Jimmy, like, she is fallible in a way that Jimmy is fallible. And the thing is that, like, they're both, like, it's weird because they're both humanly selfish, if you think about it. Like, like the moment that was so complex for me was when he sees the cat's out of the bag, and she literally, he catches her, and the amount of heartbreak that happens in Jimmy's heart, like I don't think that this is done by any stretches of the imagination. I think that there is so much hatred he has for her and Brian that it's just because it's a betrayal, right? Because this is the woman, this is the man that took their, like, everybody's, like, corning stone. Like, she was like the puzzle piece that kept everybody together, though there's a lot of things that you see in that, like, 3 years ago thing that weren't around, that's blossomed out of out of tragedy, right? But like Jimmy's reaction to it is so kind of like you can tell he wants to hate his daughter. Like, you can tell, like, instantly, it's like, why the fuck did you do this? Why did you fuck everything up? But then it's like, you see the moment where she begs her father to, like, get the fuck up out of bed. And he's like, I don't know, sweetie, I just can't do it. And then just goes back to bed.
Yeah.
And,
or she comes, like, home and sees her dad with like
two prostitutes, two sex workers.
Yeah, who were, I mean, half his age.
Half his age, like literally a biscuit older than her.
Yeah. So,
like, yeah, I mean, it's seriously complicated, but it's like complicated in the best way possible. Like, the only way I can like describe it is it's like the dream between James L. Brooks and Billy Wilder. And how they approach things. And it's this weird, wonderful world, but where a lot of things are perfect, but there's just enough cracks in the foundation to make it super fucking interesting.
I think part of the reason I love it so much is it plays into this, it's not a me idea. It's like this thought process that I've had for so much of my life about how most of the things we deal with are not like it's just our reaction to things that are happening to other people. Like, so much of the world that affects us, we have no effect on. Do you know what I mean?
It's absolutely.
Like all of these dominoes falling, and it's our reaction to it that's the important thing. Like so much of your life is just a series of circumstances that you had zero control over. But what you do have control over is how you react to it. And I mean, honestly, most of the time we react shitty. It's unfortunate, but it's humanity. And like your whole world is just a series of events that were set in motion like so long ago, you know, like it's not just that this guy had one drink too many and decided to drive. It's that his parents met and fell in love, and like he came to America and then met this like funny, cute, quirky girl. And it's just all of these things that he had no control over and that they had no control. And it's just like watching people react to that. And yeah, it's all so human, but also not, because like I said, a lot of it is like, oh, how I wish I could react to things rather than my knee jerk kind of human reaction of like just immediately getting shitty about it. And yes, I mean, exactly. Maybe that's what therapy does, is teach you to, which is weird, because like the idea of like not immediately reacting to things is such an old like concept, like that's philosophized about in like the earliest of written texts. I mean, hell, it's in the Bible. Like, don't, you know, just take a second, take a beat, like just don't immediately react, don't go to bed angry, you know, like you know, it's such a perfect show. And you know, it took a while for Ted Lasso to get that, like, oh yeah, this is, but we're in midway through season two. I don't think there's any way Harrison Ford doesn't win an Emmy next year.
Yeah. Like seriously, dude, like seriously, like he's so good. And he like it just proves to me that like with him, he has to be challenged in order to, like, you know, the writing has to challenge, and he has to be like not coerced, but like he definitely has to be pushed to be great, right? Like, yeah. If everybody is gonna like if everybody's gonna want him to play Indiana Jones, then he's gonna do Indiana Jones. But nobody can tell him to play Indiana Jones different, right? But if you give him a new role and you challenge him and you respect him as an actor and not just the icon, I feel like that's one of those things where it becomes the greatness, right? Like, yeah. Like there's like you have to push him to greatness. You can't just expect him to be great. And man, I mean, they give him a role that like, I can't not see it both being the perfect role for him, but also like kind of like, if you know who he was before, it's kind of like, oh, how did they get him to do this? You know? And hey, like, you know, that works. Like, you know, I can't say anything more than like, I'm just happy that he's got this thing, right? He's gone there. Like, he actually cares. Like, it cares in a way that we wish that he would have cared for during the 2000s, which he didn't. But I don't know if anybody really gave him a reason to care. This is a role that gives him a reason to care.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, hell, even the writing, like, I don't think that there's another show that's as well written as this one.
No.
You know?
I mean, you've got Jason Segel, Brett Goldstein, and Bill Lawrence running the show on this. And it's so, I mean, to my point about like how you, like the things that come into your life, like bad accidents, happy accidents, whatever. The confluence of these three people working together and also working with Harrison Ford is fucking bizarre.
Yeah.
Like Brett Goldstein is on Bill Lawrence's radar simply because of Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso happens because of like a commercial that they did with Jason Sudeikis, like years and years ago. It's all so bizarre. I don't know where Jason Segel comes into it, like how they meet, how the three of them conspire to do this show. It's all so bizarre and leads to like this wonderful, beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we get to reap the benefits. And it's just, I mean, it took a while to get to season two, but you know, strikes, all that stuff. But here we are, and it's like, it's one of the most emotional, like, television, not even experiences I've had watching anything. Certainly since Ted Lasso, but you know, just it emotionally, it might be better than Ted Lasso just because it's getting more complex in what it's dealing with. Ted Lasso, it never got as deep as it could have. So, and hell, the idea of getting into the therapy thing, like,
yeah,
comes from dealing with some of that stuff in Ted Lasso. Like the therapist that comes in and kind of shakes everything up, and you know, his kind of relationship with therapy and like leaning into that. And it's all just so bizarre, you know, that we got to hear. It's absolutely wonderful. It's, you know, the best show on TV that everybody's not watching, and also everybody's not going to love, because it does not pull punches on any of the bullshit. So
no, absolutely, it's by far the most challenging. I feel like it's the most challenging show on TV. Like, and yeah. I don't say that lightly, because it doesn't, like, the thing is that at face value, it's a comedy, right? And we all love comedies and stuff. But at the same time, this is not the comedy that you, like, this is not a comedy in the same way that, like, it's an easy digestible thing. Like, it really does, I can't even put it into words. Like, it makes things palpable in a way that I don't feel like most shows would approach it, right? Like it doesn't give you easy answers, but also it doesn't wallow. Like, I think that's the thing, is that it does not wallow. Like, it doesn't like allow itself to be like trauma porn. Like, do you know what I mean? Like there's a different version of this show that Harrison Ford isn't on, that Bill Lawrence and the trio are not involved with, that is an unsufferable version of the show. Like, just insufferable. Like, you would not want to watch it because it, like, wallows in self-pity. And that's not what the show does, and that's not what the show is about, right? It's about this, like, it's about, like, life, meeting life on life's terms. And sometimes it's wonderful, and sometimes it is horrible and horrifying. But we survive through with, like, you know, an ample amount of humor and understanding, at least the best, like, you know, like what it wants, like what you hope that you can do in life, right? Sometimes you don't do it. Sometimes you're Jimmy, sometimes you're not. And it's just kind of like, it's this, again, it's like the Bill Lawrence magic trick, right? Like something he's been doing since Scrubs or shit, since Spin City. Like, you know, like this whole thing of approaching it from nobody is the villain, right? Like, you, I think that you nailed it on the head, is that nobody's the villain. It's just bad decision-making.
Yeah.
Or not like, even bad decision-making, just human decision-making.
Ryan and I used to talk about this idea that, like, you're the villain in somebody's story. Everybody is the villain in somebody's story. Like,
absolutely.
You and I both, we love each other. We're best friends, brothers, like whatever labels you want to put on it. And we would both say about the other person, even if somebody was like, what are their flaws? We could probably name flaws. But if somebody was like, is Adam a good person? I'd be like, yeah, Adam's the fucking best. But somewhere out there is somebody who thinks that you're an absolute piece of shit. You ruin their day. Even if it's just some dude you cut off in LA traffic, it doesn't matter. At some point in time, you were the villain in somebody's story. There's a pretty good chance that you're actively the villain in somebody's story.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Like, and like, that is just humanity, right? The way that we look at things. And like, Jesus Christ, it's just, it's one of those things that you can't help. Like, you cannot help. Like, you can't help that. As much as you would like to try, as much as you like to think that you're sterling, but like, part of being a human is understanding that you, like, not everybody's going to like you. And point of fact, there's going to be people that hate you, but then they have their own reasons. And I feel like that's where we have de-evolved into thinking that we are all the stars of our, like, we never consider the fact that maybe we're not the star of like, of everything. That we're co-stars, that we're villains.
Are not even the co-star. Yeah, like actively the villain, you know? And when that gets mirrored back to us, when we get confronted with that, most of us we're A, baffled by it, and B, refuse to like really believe it. And therefore, we can't take responsibility for the fact that we are the villain in that story. Yep. And it's a really difficult thing to do. And when we do accept it, we just wind up, you know, hating ourselves a little bit. We can't, you know, if it's a big enough thing, a la like Jimmy or Lewis or like, you hate yourself so much that it creates all these other things, problems in your life that you can't move past. But, you know, little things like, you know, I don't want to say it's little, but things like I slept with my best friend's boyfriend, that, you know, creates drama in your life that you caused. You're the villain in that story. But like, you want to look at her and be like, well, I was going through something and I'm really sorry. But like, her friend doesn't have a lot of reasons to forgive her for that, you know? Yeah. It's such a, like, just human thing. Like, it does such a good job of presenting all of that. And I fucking love this show, man.
I do too, man. Like, it's like, I'm happy that we have it for however long we have it, and wherever they take us, I'm like, very much like Only Murderers, like, I'm gonna follow them, right? Like that's the thing that I take away from it, which is I'm so happy that we have this, that I don't know how else to actually kind of Like, I'm not sure how I actually, like, I can't put a finger on it. And I don't know why it works as well as it does. Like, I'm not saying that, like, I'm trying to dismantle it. But what I am happy about is that every year that the show is going to be on, I'm going to have the confidence of okay, whatever they're tackling, I know that they're going to bring something to it that will be uniquely them, but also like perfect. Like that's the thing, is that like it's a trust, it's an agreement, right? Like, at this point now, I'm not going to not trust them in whatever they're tackling. No matter what the subject matter is or how they're going to approach it, it will eventually turn out to be for the best as somebody who watches this show. Like, it's always going to, like, they have this kind of, like, within two seasons, they've had this ability to play with story in a way that I don't think that many shows know how to handle and know what their show is. And, like, that's, like, something that I'm like, oh shit, like, that's rare. That is rare. Like I said, like, Only Murderers this year kind of proved it took five seasons and one really shaky, like, beginning of a season, like a couple of shaky beginnings of the season. But I think that kind of informs the way that I'm looking at Shrinking now, which is like, okay, these people actually understand and know what they're doing and how they're going to handle things, even the trickiest of things. I have to let them do their thing. And I have to not worry about, like, how they're going to approach it, what they're going to approach, what I want from the story. Because, and ultimately, I feel like that's kind of, like, the best thing, is that when I'm not thinking about what I want from it, but coming to the show on its terms.
Yeah. We're barely halfway through the season?
We're two-thirds
a little of the season. Yeah.
We have another four episodes.
I don't know where they're gonna go with this, but, like, I also don't, I don't, it's not the kind of show where I want to think about speculating where they're gonna go with this. It's like, I'm so in for this ride, this emotional ride, I'm excited and, you know, also a little sad that it's probably going to be another year and a half or so before we get season three. So, yeah.
If the things are to be true, like, we're going to get a Ted Lasso season, an additional Ted Lasso season in between. So there is that, which is kind of nice, but yeah, you can't feel like another 2 years of this, like, which is literally what it is, like, two fucking years, and you're just like, Jesus Christ.
And then, hopefully there's also Bad Monkey. Like, are we gonna get another season of that, because that would be great? And, you know, apparently there's something else that Bill Lawrence is working on. It's nice that he has so much in the works, but also you know, having possibly three shows, like, in production at the same time does run thin and create longer times in between things. But in the streaming era, like, you know, he's not beholden to, like, oh, we got to hit this set schedule. It's just like, we're going to do it right. So, you know, and it's always worth the wait. So Ted Lasso every time was worth the wait. Yeah, Shrinking. If you're not watching it, we just spoiled a whole bunch of stuff, but you absolutely should be. The only person right now working in television, I think, that comes close is the guy we're going to talk about probably next week, Michael Schur. So go check out everything else we're doing over at xwingfiles.com. But more importantly, you can check out our written work over at Adam's website.
Yes, themovieowl.com, which will officially be starting back up with Motion Pictures, Logan's Column. We're going to head into the new, into the last month of the year with his new editions of the column. So that there's that to look forward to. And then, of course, I'm always writing a whole bunch of reviews and crap that like goes online. I've got a series of 4Ks that are out right now. Like the one that I would actually point you to is Mike Flanagan's third feature just got a super, super deluxe version, a 4K version, Hush. His, like I said, it's his third movie, which is arguably one of his best, if not his best feature. I love it. And it's got this super, super deluxe edition 4K, two versions of it, a bunch of special features, commentary tracks, the whole works. Read my review on it, and you will definitely see it's well worth your time. There's other stuff that's being posted right now. But like I said, all the same, movieowl.com. All the written reviews that we have there. And then, we will be back next week. I'm not sure what we're talking about. I mean,
it may just be
Michael Schur.
Yeah. So, assuming that you get a chance to, it's an easy binge. They're short episodes. I mean, you could do it in a day. It's one of those. I really think, like, if you sit down and watch it with your wife, it's going to be like, oh, no, let's keep going. Because yeah. I think it's something she'd dig to.
All right, man. I'm excited. Like, I'm definitely excited. So we will be back.
We'll see you guys next week. If nothing else, we might be talking about football. So, I haven't done a lot of that this year. It's been such a fucking weird year, man.
Weird-ass season. Weird season.
But yeah, we'll see you guys next week.
You guys next week. Comics, number 3, Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit. Number 4, Mario. Number 5, Weird Al. Number 6, Batman. Number 7, Kal-El. Number 8, Simpsons. Number 9, TV. Number 10, every single band that I stole all their MP3s. But they're really all sold out. See it all together if you're with me now.